My name is Harry. Did I say I'm an alcoholic?
Yes.
Well, I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I appreciate it. You come here tonight and allow me to speak. Thank you, Larry, for asking me. It's an honor. It's always an honor to speak. And I've always been told not to refuse when asked to speak. You know, never say no. So here I am. So if you want me to do something else, like make coffee, just remember that. I won't say no. So I will tell you a little about my experience, strength, and hope. My sobriety date is 9/8/1975. I was born at 2 hours before that, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I've been here ever since. Saying, "Oh, alcoholic!" I don't mean. My home group is Hillside, and my sponsor is Bill R. So your grand sponsor is Bill R. And unfortunately, Bill's sponsor is God. So you're really good shape. So Bill's been my sponsor for like over 20 years. A great guy, great man. And so I just tell you a little about myself. My first drink was at the age of 14. My family, I grew up in, I was born here in Valdosta, Georgia. And I grew up in New York. So I'm really slightly confused native. I'm Georgia, New York. So I was born here. My father was in the service. And my father's from Yonkers, and my mother was from East Orange, New Jersey. So I grew up in New York. My mom really was not that much of a drinker. I think I've seen my mom maybe had a couple of drinks. My father, he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I can say that he's an alcoholic. So my experience with alcohol was I thought that I didn't know the difference between normal and abnormal drinking. I had no concept. I thought when you drank across the board, that's what happened to you. You drank too much, you blacked out. I never heard of anybody not drinking or sipping a drink or maybe getting slightly intoxicated and go, "Oh, I'm tipsy, I think I'll stop." That was never in my vocabulary. I drank to get drunk. I drank for effect. I loved to get absolutely loaded. And I heard there a couple of days ago, JJ, he said, and it made a lot of sense to me. He said, alcohol flipped that switch for me. It just did something for me. And that's what it was when I first had my first drink of alcohol. And I really, really did not want to become... my father, when he would drink, was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde person. He really didn't know what was going to happen when my father got home. There was no way of knowing, was it going to be violent or. And I thought I would never be like my father when I drank. And that's exactly what happened to me when I drank. I was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality. One minute I was a nice guy, next minute I was an animal. But I was blacking out just about every time I drank. My first drink when I drank at the age of 14, I blacked out drinking. So I really didn't know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to find out that there was something definitely wrong with my behavior after, some guys ringing in my face or, pumping gas, and I'm waking up pumping gas going, "What am I doing here?" Or wake up in New York City going, "What am I doing in a McDonald's in New York City?" We drove down from the Catskill. So, I knew there was not, that was not normal behavior. Did a lot of drinking. I did not associate with anybody who did not drink. And this was during the late 60s, early 70s, when the whole hippie thing was out. And I also played music for a living. And I hung out with a lot of guys who were a lot older than me. And I got into some of the other stuff, too. I won't talk about that too much. But, that period of time was, love and peace and hallucinogenics. And, and that's just the way it was. And my town, just say a little history. My town, Walden, New York, the day of Woodstock was bumper to bumper. And the first street light was 5 miles away. And I thought, wow, this is the strangest bunch of people I've ever seen in my life. Long hair walking around. I thought, boy, this is weird, So I grew up in that period. I played with musicians, and I loved playing music. And I got involved with a lot of musicians in that area, and that's what we did. We, you know, partied and drank and practiced all day and played music. And, you know, I thought, you know, that period, it was good. My father finally had stopped drinking. He was in his 30s. And I'll say this, too. I also grew up down in the city, New York, and we got out of the city. We got out of Yonkers and moved to upstate New York, which was like a total shock for us as a kid. You know, we're living on streets, and, you know, and all of a sudden we're out in the woods, and there's like, we're hearing crickets, and, you know, there's like no car noise and no sirens, you know, and, you know, it was a little bit different. You know, a lot of trees, you know, not a lot of kids to hang out. You know, we had gangs, you know, all that. You know, you didn't have a gang, you know, you hung out. You know, look at the fish in the water during the day, you know. You know, so we'd hang out on the corners, you know. So it was quite a shock of a change. So anyway, we moved to Middletown, New York. My father sobered up. And I thought that was great, the old man. You know, he was 30 years old. He needed to retire from his drinking habit. And we did a lot of partying, me and my father. A lot of partying. I was also kind of his designated driver. When he got drunk, we go to the Playboy Club or some of these other clubs, and I was driving for him, and I was also getting drunk too. And I was thinking about Larry. Me and Larry talked today, and he had a babysitter come in, and I was thinking, you know, my father had babysitters too, but we felt very safe because it usually was a cop car, you know, tagging the guy that was babysitting us, you know, so it was a very interesting babysitter. And I think now he's in federal pen for doing, I'm not sure what, but so it was, you know, it was that kind of lifestyle too, you know. So, but anyway, that I'm saying that to tell you a little bit later on when I came into the program what happened to me. I grew up as a Catholic. My grandmother on my mother's side was a Salvation Army, and every time she would come up and visit my father would get into it. And she would always say, "Heathen, get behind me, Satan." So, you know, my father was a little bit different than what my grandmother. And my grandmother would I can remember being in New Jersey with my grandmother in Jersey City. And all of a sudden, just she'd say, "Get down on your knees. We're praying right here in the street." And it just scared the daylights out of me as a kid. I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, God's going to get you. We're praying. Get down on your knees. I'm going, whoa. Holy crap, I better not move a muscle. I'm a dead meat, you know what I mean? So, you know, between that and growing up on the streets and you know, growing up, understand something. I had a really big misconception of religion and God and spirituality. I had no understanding whatsoever. You know, I lived on Ashburton Avenue in the city, and there was a candy store across the street, and the church was directly across the street. We robbed the candy store, and I go and do confession before I go to church. You know what I mean? So I had no concept at all. So my father came into the program, and I continued to drink. My father kept laying literature around, and, you know, 24 questions. I don't remember, 12 questions about alcohol, are you an alcoholic or not, and 24 questions, and big book, hell of stuff laying around the house. And I continued to party, and I would go to the house, and my father, the other thing is, too, my father had a grocery store for a while, and we had, like, tons and tons of booze down in the basement. And I think that was sort of a catalyst for me, too. It was very, very accessible for me. I'm talking about cases of everything you could think of. I could wipe a case out. My father would never miss it. You know what I mean? And drinking, when I got old enough, for him was 15, 16 years, it was no problem for me drinking with my father. It was very, very normal to be drinking with my father. And then to be in the clubs in the city as a child, the bars, the neighborhood bars. That's where the kids hung out with the adults or outside in the street next to the corners. You know what I mean? It was a very, you know, so that was my understanding of alcoholism and of drinking and my relationship with it and my relationship with my God. So my father comes in the program, and I come home, and there's these weird people at the house, priests, gangsters. I mean, everything, and they're playing, and they're laughing, and they're drinking coffee, and playing badminton, and I'm going, cops, I'm going, what the heck are these people? And I thought, what are these? They're not drinking, and they're laughing, and they're telling jokes, and, you know, it was you people, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought my father had gotten some kind of cult or something, because, man, it was, you know, the priest is telling jokes, and I'm going, what the heck is this deal? I mean, you know, and cops, and I mean, it was just a whole mesh of different people, and I'm going, this is, you know, okay, Pop, see you later. Great party. I think I'll go hang out with my buddies and go drink now, you know. My last drunk was, I had two guys that came back from the service. This was 1974, 75, summer of 75, going into September, and they were in the service, and they came back, and we went on a tear for a week, and ended up drinking for 3 days straight, staying up 3 days straight. And I, for the first time I can remember, on the second day that we were out drinking, I came home, and it was for the first time that I actually had to drink at the age of 19 years old just to not shake, just to get back to a state of normalcy, just to come back to, you know what I mean, just to feel normal. So it had changed for me. But I did have another experience when I was 16. I never forget that. It was St. Patty's Day. It was snowing. And I was in a small bar, and they let us in to drink. And I can remember also shaking as I took that drink. It was just like going down, and I knew that was there was something wrong with that, you know. So I went on a three-day tear with these guys. Well, they came up for the whole week. The last 3 days was really bad. You know, I just stayed up drinking, and I thought, you know, I got to do something about this drinking. It's gotten out of hand. It's gotten way out of hand. I didn't even know where I was half the time. You know what I mean? I went to my first meeting. I got in some brawl with some guy in the parking lot. I'm not really exactly sure what happened, but I ended up bruising, hurting one of my legs in a fight in the gravel. And I said, this is it. Got to go. And I had this tremendous sense of peace come over me. And I went to my first AA meeting in New Jersey. The guy who drove me home, my very, very best friend, said, you're not an alcoholic, because if you were, I am. 6 months later, guess who's in the program? Tom Carlo. I'll say his name now because he's passed away. He passed away with 19 years of sobriety. So I went to my first meeting in East Patterson. Now, I got to tell you something. 1975 in New York, meetings were just a little bit different. A little bit different. 90 meetings, 90 days. Take the cotton out of yours and shove it in your mouth. You didn't say nothing. We read the preamble, serenity prayer into the meeting. Didn't read how it works. Didn't read the promises. Didn't read the traditions. Didn't have chips. They gave you a lighter or a beer mug of all things for 1 year. I never could figure that out, a beer mug. And they'd pat you on the back and go, okay, great job. What do you want from us? A year? Huh? You're sober. What do you want? You know what I mean? And the reason why I'm saying that, it really doesn't matter. You know what I mean? We now read how it works. We now do the promises. We read the traditions. And for a long time, I had a problem. I had a hard time adjusting to the changes. A lot of changes. Holding hands during the meeting. During the Lord's Prayer. It was a lot of changes. And probably the best example who was able to do the change was Pat W. I'll never forget the day. Pat was more than another one of my sponsors. And I seen the change. He always had the capacity to, that the ability to change with the program, how we dealt with things. I was starting to get too rigid. And when I started traveling, I started getting back into playing and going to different cities and different states. Everybody did it differently. You know what I mean? The white chip was different than the red chip. Red chip was, I was like, Jesus, how are they staying sober down here in Florida? They're not doing it like they're doing in Georgia. You know what I mean? So it was tough for me to get out of that mindset when I moved out of New York. You know what I mean? The rate how it works, I'm going, when are we going to get to the meeting here? You know what I mean? You know, it took a while for me to get adjusted. And I got to say this too, when I first came in up north, and I'm saying this up north because that's where I came in. Don't really take it personal, please. It's just the way it was. There was a lot of priests in the program. There was a lot of cops in the program. There was a lot of other type of characters in the program. And I needed to see that. I did not need to see that you were, just for Harry O'Brien, that you were all a bunch of goody-two-shoes shoes all of a sudden. That would have blown my mind, that all of a sudden, golly gee willikers, I'm all of a sudden saved and I'm a saint and I don't rob and steal and pilgrimage anymore. You know what I'm saying? I could not have grasped it if you guys were just a bunch of wonderful, wonderful people right away. Because that's what always turned me off when I had gone to church. I'm seeing one thing and you're doing another. You know what I mean? I didn't need to see that. I needed to see that you were still human beings. And then by a miracle that you were sober. And then eventually that the change would come. But I needed to see the you as you in your raw, authentic self. And that you were saved by the grace of God. And that the change was going to come. And the change was going to come for me. But I needed a different example. I needed to see the guy with the knuckles all twisted up and the nose like this and knowing exactly what he was all about and him having peace in his eye and saying, hey, kid, don't take yourself so serious. It's going to be okay. And I go, what the heck am I? What is this? What am I seeing? And I didn't know what I was seeing. I was stopped drinking, but I believe I had a spiritual awakening that God had led me here because I cried out for help. I cried out for something, and I was brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. And I seen the dramatic. I needed to see that kind of. And I've said this many, many times before. Any priest was not going to change me. It was the guy that I knew that had one hell of a life, violent, angry, pissed off. And see the miraculous change in him. That was a tremendous, powerful example of me, of what God can do to somebody. The tremendous love that this God had. That's what I needed to see. And not knowing what I was seeing. Because I was closed, afraid, narrow-minded. I had no concept. And that's the reason why I like the way the 12 steps are written. If 12 was butted up against number 1... I don't think I would have made it. I needed to be fed very slowly, spiritually, the truth. I could have not have grasped it, could not have swallowed it, the changes that needed to be done in my life. I could have not have swallowed it. It was too much light, too much truth beyond me. I needed to stop drinking, and I would say, well, how do you stay sober? I needed them to say, don't drink. I went, oh. Wow, I never thought of that one. Don't drink. Wow, that's a concept. You know what I mean? Don't take yourself so serious. Go to meetings. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's the way I had to take it. I was way out there on left field when I got here. And the other thing was very important in that area was 12-stepping. Ghana picked up a lot of guys. It was small communities, one street like towns. There was not a lot of treatment centers at that time. And it was nothing for us to go and get somebody and take them to a meeting. And they might be even slightly intoxicated, but we were taking them to meetings, you know. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, you know. And we take them and go to meetings, you know what I mean, and give them coffee, and they'd be shaking and, you know, and have a cigarette. And they'd be, back then you could smoke, and you know, and that's the way it was. And also, too, which was very, very critical for me was... We'd go to different towns, Ackworth. A group of us would speak maybe in Woodstock. You know what I mean? A group from Woodstock would come here and speak here, 3 speakers or a carload. And I got a lot of very close fellowship by going and taking a trip with people, going to Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut, and speaking, you know. Leader and then other speakers, 2 other speakers. It's not, you know, didn't have one like I got to talk for an hour. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, I'll speak for 15 minutes and shut my mouth. And, you know, so about a year living in New York, I moved out of New York and I came down here. I got out of New York because it got just too cold for me. I just like, you know, I realized I could sober up and I can leave. It was November. It was goddamn cold out. I wasn't drunk and I went, you know, I can go. I don't have to stay here. Hello? You know what I mean? It's cold. Go somewhere where it's warm. So I came to Georgia. And I moved down here. And after 1 year, I came down to New York. I mean, from New York down here. I also DJed in New York my first year, too, in a nightclub in New York. And I so I needed to get out of New York. It was time for me to get out of New York. And I came down here, and I started going to meetings down here. My first meeting was the Biscayne Room, which used to be on Peachtree. I think it was Peachtree, Biscayne. Small. They used to detox people in the back, you know, in the back of the room. Place had a feeling about it, man. You know what I mean? It was just something about that place. You could sense the spirit. You know what I mean? That there was love, compassion. There was something there about that building, about those people. They were right at the, and we are right at the right front core, front lines of I think, God's handiwork. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? And I got to say this, too. It took me a while. It took me a while to get to say the word God that is written, that I believe it is now, which is constantly changing for me. It took me a while to get to understand the word God. And I think, and it's just my, please, anything that I say is just my personal opinion. Don't take it any other way. If you can do something with it, great. If you can't, fine. But I believe God has tremendous love for us as alcoholics. You know what I mean? And this program is designed, just my personal opinion, please, with God's grace and love on it. Those 12 steps get right to the meat of the issue. Is that I have a disease which is called alcoholism. And I have an obsession of the mind, compulsion, that needs to change. It needs to get to the rock core. It needs to break and snap that obsessive mind, compulsive, negative thinking. And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous get right to the issue. And I think it was designed very, 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 with no doubt in my mind, by the hand of God. There's no doubt. And it's funny that I'm talking about God so much, because when I first got here, that was like the last thing I wanted to talk about or hear about. He's got a very good sense of humor, God, too, doesn't he? He's got me talking about him. So, you know, he's gone, you know, the kid down there, Jesus, he's doing it, thank you. You know, so... So it took me a while to get to the word guy. And then the second meeting was at Rebus Club, the old Rebus Club, which was a very old building and had some quite a few characters in there. Lynn B., God bless Lynn B. Lynn B. used to do all the taping for, like, Marietta Roundup and all that. And May was an old Southern woman, hairdresser. Just absolutely wild. I mean, she shot her husband with the leg with a shotgun. I mean, she was quite a character. And if she didn't like what you say, she'd just get up and say, "You're just full of absolute crap." And then she'd scare the hell out of me. You know what I mean? I didn't know what to do about that woman, you know. Kind of toke line. Well, don't drink and go to meetings. Okay, man. You know, she would just lay you out. You know, so I met some great boy. You know, I met you folks, Roy and Dottie, and I met Mike, you know, and it's a little scary. Is there anybody else in here, gang, that we know back then? But so I met my, so I went to a lot of meetings. I went to Rebus Club, and I started developing a relationship with this God. And I, for a long time, I kind of skirted off of that fourth step. I really, you know, I really didn't, I got him when I was 19 years old. I don't know if that was part or not, or maybe I'm using that as an excuse right now. I don't know. But I met this guy, Bob B., and we started traveling again on the road. Prior to that, I got a really good job down here working for a grocery store, and I did that for a year, and I was absolutely miserable. I cut my hair. I thought that was my problem, you know. Cut the old hair, and I started doing this job. I was freaking miserable. My father comes down from New York, and he says, "Harry, what are you doing, man? You make me want to throw up." He says, "You're so responsible." He says, "What? You know, why? For what reason? You know, I mean, play your music. Do your passion." And that's what I did. And I met this guy, Bob B., hair down to here, and he was an absolute freaking wild man. Played with a huge, very big band, very famous band. And I was Mr. Very Serious, and Bob was the exact opposite. And I roomed with this guy on the road, which is a trip in itself, because Bob had, you know, maybe 20 years of antics, maybe 10 years of antics of being on the road and playing goof jobs on new members of the band. It's like joining a new club, you know. The new guy is the one that gets all the jokes, you know, and I was the new guy. So I learned a lot from Bob. But what I learned from Bob is this. It doesn't matter. Bob could walk up to anybody, and he could talk to them, and you could see the walls coming in. He had that capacity to bring a wall down with people, anybody, just literally walk up and talk to you. He didn't have that, oh, maybe I shouldn't. They didn't have that in him. He just walked right up to you and talked to you. It didn't matter who you were. And I learned that from Bob Burns. Not to take yourself so serious. Enjoy your life. And that's what I learned from Bob. And I also learned from Bob that if you don't continue to go to meetings, you're going to go back out. And Bob went back out. I never forget, I was in Daytona Beach, and I was walking back in the club, and Bob turned around and blew marijuana right in my face. And I went, I guess you're not straight anymore, huh, Bob? You know, in Daytona Beach. You know, and Bob, you know, me and Bob used to go on a lot of 12-step calls. We've done some 12-step calls, me and Bob. And Bob was like my 12-step partner buddy. And Bob, his first step call, I just got to tell you this one story about Bob. We went on a 12-step call. Let me say something about 12-step calls. It doesn't matter how long you're sober. Go. Do not go by yourself. Always take somebody with you with more sobriety. If you've got 10 days, go. You got a day. Because they're not going to, from my experience, they're not going to ask me with 35 years how I stayed sober. Because they probably think I'm full of crap. But if you've got a day, you got a week, they're probably going to listen to you. Because that when I had 30 days, they asked me. They didn't care about the guy who had 2 years or a year. They wouldn't know how I stayed sober 30 days. How did you do it? So go. Do not go by yourself. Do not go by yourself. So me and Bob went on this 12-step call, and we brought this other guy named Frank, tall, 6'6" biker, tattoos out the yin-yang. And Bob washed his car, bought a brand-new shirt, brand-new pants, and we were going on a 12-step call. We were 12-stepping this guy from Buckhead. He was a guitar player, well-known guitar player. He admired Bob, wanted Bob to go 12-step call him. We went down to the house, which was the middle of June. I don't remember, it was a beautiful sunny day. And we get down here, and this guy comes out, and he's wearing an Oni Bermuda shorts. And you know how we are. And he comes down, he sits down, and we start talking to him, and Bob starts laying into him and talk to him that, you should go. We need to take you to the hospital. And the guy's going, I don't know if I want to go. Maybe I will. We get him a bottle to get him down to the hospital. And Bob is still talking. Come on, let's go. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a big bird of turd would land right on Bob's shoulder. This big black turd landed right on his shoulder. And we all started cracking up laughing. And the guy says, you know what? I think I'll go now. I think I'll go now. And Bob just shut up. He's like, God dang it, a bird just pooped right on my shoulder. I was like, you got the message, right? God's saying, shut the hell up. It's not about you, it's about God. And God said, boom, there it is. He said, all right, I'm going. We all started cracking up. So we took him to a hospital. And we got him there. And he just kept eyeballing the 6'6" biker. And so they got him back in the emergency room. And all of a sudden, I hear stuff flying back there. And evidently, this guy didn't like the biker, and he threw this, they had him handcuffed. I'm not really sure what happened, but Steve went back there, and, he said, I got to go to the bathroom. And so Steve gives him the cup, and the guy throws the urine in Steve's face. So Steve gives him a shot, So anyway, this guy stays sober a year, and Steve buys him a urinal for his birthday, for his anniversary. So my point is this, don't ever deny or stop yourself from going on a 12-step call, because you never know what's going to happen. You know what I mean? You never know. You never know the miracles that you're going to see. You never know, because you're right on the front lines. And I'll tell you something else. Those guys that Frank, we took to the hospital. Bob, those guys that I've gone on 12-step calls with, and they've gone on 12-step calls with me, are probably have been the closest to me for that fact, by taking somebody and taking them to the hospital. You know what I mean? Because there's just something about that extra little, you know what I mean, helping another alcoholic. I think God lays just a little bit more something on you. You know what I mean? And there's other, so So where am I at with the steps? I don't even know. See how I avoided the steps? I totally stopped talking about the steps, didn't I? So let me say this to you. The 12 steps of alcoholics, I did a 4-step inventory, and I did my 5th step. I've done many, many, many inventories, many spot-checked inventories, many inventories, because I think it's important that I needed to get to the root of the issue. I needed to see it down on paper, what my problem was. So for me, I did it right out of the big book. I've done all the steps out of the big book, and I've done them wrong, too. I've done them butt-ass backwards, excuse my language. But it was critical that I move and continue to move forward with the steps. You know what I mean? I didn't think I did a really good fourth step. My sponsor said, don't worry about it. Just move, go forward. Just continue to move forward. It doesn't have to be perfect, you know? So I moved on with my steps and stayed on the road for a while and then got off the road. It got to be too much, just way too much. I was having way too much fun. It was ridiculous. You know, I wanted some misery, so I came home and did something else. You know, we can't stay happy forever. You know what I mean? You know, got to have a little twist or it. So I got out of the road, and I came home, and then 1983, I'll tell this story. I had 8 years of sobriety at the time, and I won't go really, really deep into it. I'm just going to tell you this. I stopped to help this guy on the side of the road, and coming from an AA meeting at the Swingers Club, Lynn B. was the last guy, one of the last guys that held my hand during the Lord's Prayer. And I'll never forget that guy. And stopped out this guy on the side of the road. I knew quite a bit about cars. It was the day of carburetors. I was priming this guy's carburetor. The timing between the gas and me and his hand on the ignition changed. The car blew up, caught me on fire. I'm in flames. I know there's a creek behind me. Don't know how deep it is. Can't see it because it caught me right square in the face. And I ran to the creek. Put it out. Next thing I remember, I'm in the water. I hear my neck snap. I hear the flames go out. And I'm laying on my back. 28 years old. I thought, okay, I can get up. I try to get up. Not getting up. I start losing my breathing. I thought this is... not good. I try to get up again, not getting up. Start losing control of my right arm. I said, I can't lose control of this arm. Next thing I remember is I realizing that I'm not getting out of this hole. I also all of a sudden had this tremendous sense of peace come over me. A thickness. I really can't explain it. It was all of a sudden, it was like something had grabbed a hold of me, like a cocoon, like something had put its arms around me, like hugging me. I'll be very perfectly honest with you. I could have gone right then and there. It would not have mattered to me. I didn't feel no fear or anger. Actually, it was the total opposite. And I always said that death had my attention, and I realize now it was life that had my attention. It was not death. See, because at that moment, at that point, the thing that I've come to understand now is that what had happened is that I was in the presence of God. There was a change, a major change. I could have cared less about the car. My car still ran on top of the hill. It didn't matter to me what I thought I was or what I should have been. Nothing mattered except my relationship with that power. It had my 100% fullest attention. Fullest attention. And this thought came to me. Harry, you're going to learn some more about yourself than you have ever learned in your lifetime. And I went, who in the heck is saying that to me? Can somebody else talk to me besides that voice? You know what I mean? Because I was, and the strangest things happened. I had this tremendous sense of exhilaration and excitement come up in me. And I thought, it does not match what's happening to me. Because I perceived that in order to have that kind of peace and excitement or sensibility of lifeness, it's because maybe I got a brand new Corvette, a new job, you know what I mean? A new relationship, You know what I mean? I really had no idea of this, of what it was really, what was really, really important. So, right after that, somebody comes and somebody jumps down in that ditch and they come and get me. And they said, they start telling me, what's your social security? You know, they try to keep me awake. Eventually, the ambulance show up and they get me, and they get me to the hospital. And I'll tell you one other thing that I thought of that I almost forgot, which is very, very important, was my relationship with my family and my friends. That was important to me, those two things. Because I'll tell you something, I found out something, and I know you're not a rock, I know everybody understands this. When it comes down to it, you're not taking anything. I was not taking anything. I can't take the car. I can't take any of the material things. It's not coming with me. Is it really that important? Maybe in a relative sense, we've got to have vehicles to drive. But in the absolute truth, is it important? No. It's not going to make me happy. Things are not going to make me happy. When I say happy, I'm saying peace of mind. Peace of mind. That for me, I'm just speaking for Harry O'Brien, there's a difference between peace of mind and happiness. I want peace of mind. That's what I want. That's what I want. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, to be able to do, say, and feel what I couldn't have done in my own power, a new state of consciousness, a new being. That's what happens to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've become a vehicle for God's grace and God's love to help one another. Something has changed. And the 12 step of Alcoholics Anonymous makes that change. Continue to take personal inventory. It's a daily thing. I have to continue to stop and realize, am I being of service to God? Am I being of service to God, or am I being of service to my ego? What is it? Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. Not semi-conscious. Not next week's consciousness. Right now's consciousness. Right now. Am I in relationship to God right now? Am I in relationship to God right now? Those things have had to change for me. And it's a continuous process. I'm no saint. You know what I mean? I'm a human being just like everybody else. I have my deals, you know, my little battles in my mind. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And it's something that I have to continue to practice is those prayers. You know what I mean? And that third step prayer, my God, it's in a perfect place. You know what I mean? It gets right to it in the big book, the third step prayer. So it's been quite a journey for me, and I know we're getting close to the hour. It's been a very, very interesting journey for me. And I've met some great people. I'll just tell you a couple of things that have happened as a result after my accident. Because sometimes it's good to say what's happened after, but it's always been, oh, wow, that's happened, and what has happened with our lives. I think the newcomer or people that have gone through tragedies in their life, I think you need to hear the other side of it as well. Louis Gazzard has gotten an article about the accident. And I started getting people from all over the country starting to write to me. I'd have people come to the hospital. I didn't know these people from Jack Adam, but they were coming there to see me in the hospital. And my point to you is this, there is so much good people out there. So much good people, but I am the one that's got the problem. I can either look at what's bad with this world or what's good with this world. And I had people coming to me, and let me say this, that I've come to find out, and please just bear with me. This is just my personal opinion. I always thought that I had no control of the bad things that happened in my life. I have no control of what's happened to the good things of my life. I could not move a muscle and say, don't help me. And it was coming out of the woodwork. I was so wiped out physically that people were coming out of the woodwork to help me. And I could not stop it. I could not stop what's happening. It was absolutely incredible. And I always got this misperception of, well, something good's going to happen as a direct result of Harry O'Brien. No, that's not the case. It's not the case. You know what I mean? Maybe on something like helping an ant out of the house or feed a cat. You know what I mean? But when it comes to God, God's power moving, you know what I mean? It's much greater than me. You know? So we had Louis Gazzard, one of my good buddies here, Mike, wrote an article that went to Louis Gazzard, and it started hitting all over the country, and I started getting a lot of letters. And then in May of 1984, We set up a trust fund for me as well. In May of 1984, I got a letter from President Reagan. And I had a lot of the news people come down and see me. You know, it's a shame you can't comb your hair when you're all in, you know, when you're in your attraction. You know what I mean? It's like, can you put a little makeup on me? For, no. I don't look my best right now. You sure you want to do this today? No, but I can't tell. But anyway, so I had a lot of reaching out, you know, a letter from Reagan, and then I started getting playing music again. I mean, now I started becoming an engineer and producer, and I started doing that for a living. I no longer could play music because I lost my dexterity in my fingers. So if you're a musician, let me say this to you. Don't take that for granted because it can be taken away very quickly. Whatever your gifts are, continue your gifts. Don't stop your passions because it can be gone in a blink of an eye. So I started in engineering, and then 1994, I ended up on a very big hit called Boomp, There It Is. And maybe it'll get played tonight. I don't know. I don't know. It really depends on the DJ. Do I have to give you that $10 to play the song tonight? Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. So, yeah, so I got this. I'm hearing this. I'm in my neighborhood, and this guy's throwing garbage going, Boomp, There It Is. I'm going, I did that song last year. I didn't know that hook line. You know what I mean? And I called one of the guys in the bass and said, man, where have you been? Has your head been in the closet or something? I mean, that song has like jumped up to like 20 on the charts and it's climbing to number one. I'm going, okay, I didn't know, you know? So you never know what's going to happen. What God's going, one little thing that God's going to throw and go, you know what? Here it goes. Because I've always wanted platinum albums. You know what I mean? I've always wanted them, you know? And bingo, this thing comes up. God throws a sidewinder and gives me the song out of nowhere, you know? So you never know what's going to happen. You've got to continue to move forward. And we've got 5 minutes. And let me say this to you, and I will be quiet. I really will be quiet. No matter what you're going through, this is my hope for you. No matter what you're going through in your life, continue to move forward. Continue to move forward. You are stepped into the greatest thing in your life is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let the walls down. Trust. Trust. Be of service. Don't take yourself so, I won't use the next word, serious. Because this program is designed for us to continue to stay sober and have a great life if we choose to. It does not mean that life is not going to throw things at us. But I'll tell you what happens with the 12 steps. God has a way of working things out. God has a way of working things out. So please, stay around long enough to find out what that is. Because I will tell you this. This deal really does work. Really does work. It does. And it is very real. Very real. So don't deny the opportunity to live a different life and a different existence. And the word is love. And the word is God. And the word is service. And I hope you get to that point and can open your heart up enough to see that. Because you've been given an opportunity. Don't think that you're here by mistake. You're here to help somebody that's going to walk in here. Wait for the miracle. You'll go, and I will shout with this, I swear. You'll go, oh my God. It's true. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. That with their hatred, their love, but there's doubt, hope. Just, I don't remember the rest of it right now. So thank you. You understand what I'm saying? Thank you very much. Have fun tonight. Thank you.